If we could just first get you to state your name for the record.
Margaret Levy.
Thank you. I'm Millie Lake.
And I'm Anne Greenlee.
And the date is?
September 29th.
I think it's the 28th.
Oh, 28th.
Yeah. September
28th, 2010.
So, basically, we'd like you to tell us in your own words about the negotiation process leading up to the settlement between Nike and CGT in July 2010. And we thought you could start by describing the key issues in the negotiation as you perceived them and how the matter first came to your attention.
Let me start from the beginning, how the matter came to my attention, which was really through the Advisory Committee on Trademarks and Licensing, and I can't remember the exact date now. I'd have to look it up on the records, but I think you have some of those. When it was brought to the attention of the Advisory Committee on Trademarks and Licensing, which I co-chair and have for some time, there had been a series of closures of factories in Honduras, and the workers had not received their terminal compensation as mandated by Honduran law. And we learned about this case before we started hearing about the case before we actually took it up. It was probably some months after the closure before it actually became an issue in front of the committee as opposed to something we were hearing about. And then we engaged in the major issue that it raised was that it seemed to be that these factories were subcontractors of contractors of Nike's, and that there was a real possibility that UW logoed goods had been produced in the factories. And if that was the case, then it was very much something our committee had to deal with, because it meant that Nike was potentially in violation of our code of conduct for licensees. Now, the advisory committee can only, in principle, deal with cases in which the licensee has actually violated the code, and the code is quite narrow. So it means that the way it is often read is that actual licensed product had to be for this university, whatever university is considering it, had to have been produced in those factories. So two things came up fairly quickly. One, Nike was quite responsive to our demands for information at one level. They appeared and came and talked to us, some of their corporate social responsibility people. They also wrote letters in response to our questions or emails. And basically, they claimed that during the crucial period, no licensed goods for the University of Washington had been produced in these factories. That in itself created a problem, because according to the disclosures that they had done, Nike had done and was obligated to do with WRC and with FLA or through some series of disclosure lists, Nike had claimed that UW product was being produced at least one of these factories, if not both. So at least, at the minimum, there was a problem and a potential violation of the code, though a fairly minimal one, about not properly disclosing where their product was made, which makes it very hard for us as a committee to deal with it. The larger issue, of course, was that these workers were not getting compensated. And nobody disagreed that they weren't. And nobody disagreed that the Honduran law required that they should be at a higher level than they had received so far. What was at issue was how much Nike was actually responsible for that payment, and how hard they had, at the least, they were responsible, again, by fairly universal agreement, including Nike's. They were responsible for pressuring their immediate subcontractors, which were Vision Techs and what was the other one?
Hugger,
right, sorry. They were responsible for pressuring them to pay the workers. what we understood was that there was some attempt to do that by selling whatever was left in the factories. There was a whole period in which gates were locked and access to the material that was left in the factories wasn't, there was no access, and we pressured Nike to make sure that the government provide that access and that these security guards be gotten rid of. All of this happening, of course, in a context in which Honduran government was pretty dysfunctional, right? This was during the period when it was unclear who was the real government and whether it was an appropriate and legal government. And again, no one was really paying attention to this issue from the government side. They had other things to worry about. So there was the question of whether the workers had actually gotten all that was the minimum they could have gotten, which was whatever was left of the assets from the two companies, and ensuring that Nike did everything possible to make sure that they did. And then there was the question of the capacity of the contractors, the immediate contractors of these bankrupted factories, their capacity to pay. And Nike insisted that it had looked at their records prior to contracting them, and they looked very solvent, and when and had the capacity to deal with these kinds of issues. But when it came down to it, and the factories had actually closed, they were less solvent, partially because of the financial crisis, international financial crisis, partially because their records hadn't been as good as Nike had thought, and we also suspected possibly because Nike didn't do its due diligence in checking on these factories prior, which is part of its responsibility. Nike continued to claim up until very close to the last minute, and including the last minute, actually, because the way the settlement evolved, they were not actually directly paying for terminal compensation, that this was the responsibility of the factories, the companies that had contracted the factories that closed. They also claimed throughout much of this process that the CGT, the union, had and or members of workers had made private deals with the companies and had basically settled in a variety of ways. So they were telling us in a large number of different dimensions that they'd done all they could, that they didn't have much obligation, and that it was over for them. And the people we were dealing with directly, which included Caitlin Morris and some of the other people at that sort of level, again, I can look up the names for you, but they're part of the public record, who came to visit with us and talk to us and were quite responsive on the phone, were having a huge, you could see that they were feeling stressed. That they, and I know Caitlin pretty well, and I saw her in a variety of other supply chain kinds of environments. We're part of a group called Just Supply Chains that is a national group that Richard Locke and Josh Cohn initially organized of NGOs and corporate social responsibility people from companies and academics and WRC, FLA, and others. In one of those meetings, she was pressed privately in a little sort of corridor meeting by me, the executive director of WRC, and the director of Makia Solidarity, Linda Yance, about what Nike was doing here and why it couldn't come to some terms and do something about the terminal compensation. And you could see that she was just feeling pushed and pulled, that she wanted to do something and that the hierarchy wasn't quite letting her do anything, but she was still taking the Nike line, right? So you could see the stress, but there was no question. She was saying, we can't do anything. We've done everything we can. I'll explore some additional avenues, but I don't think they're there. Leave me alone. You know, why is Nike always getting attacked? There are other companies that are worse. A standard sort of Nike response. So up until the very end, they were saying they didn't really, it wasn't really their problem anymore. They'd done all they could to solve this problem. They felt very badly for the workers. They did offer and put on the table, as it were, a training program, which they would do jointly with the companies, with Hugger and Vision Tax, but with no serious promises of jobs at the other end of it. So they were retraining workers or training workers, but not necessarily giving them jobs. And this didn't seem satisfactory to us, nor did it meet the legal requirements to pay the workers their terminal compensation. Right. So we said that does not, we still think there's a real problem here. So the committee engaged in considerable due diligence. I mean, we made sure we asked every possible question that we could think of to establish responsibility, to figure out what had been done, what hadn't been done, what the courts had done, what the union had done, what Nike had or had not done. Got every piece of evidence we could before we reached the conclusion that we found Nike in violation of our code of conduct on these two dimensions. One, the, as I said, not minor, but relative to the other, relatively less important, disclosure issue, which we knew was fairly easy to correct but and is an industry-wide problem, and the other being the terminal compensation issue. And as an advisory committee, we went to the president with that. And I should say one other thing in the reasoning of the committee that was quite crucial here was that at some level we didn't really care whether there was licensed product made or not. The argument that we most of us bought as committee members, and it was a consensual piece of advice, it was unanimous in the committee, you know, for us to say that they were, we believe they were in violation of the code and that the president should agree and should terminate Nike's license when it came up for renewal in December. But what was sort of the basis for our claim was that Nike, we want to deal with licensees who have a responsibility, who have a reputation, a high and well-earned reputation for responsible production. And that even if it wasn't our logo goods being made in the factory, they were a licensee of ours. There was some question about whether they could have been made there. There was clearly some possibility of that. And it still was inappropriate for our licensees to engage in that kind of behavior. Now, one of the reasons, and I made this argument quite forcefully in the committee, one of the reasons that we didn't say immediate termination of the license was because narrowly construed, they could hang us up with lawyers because they could probably demonstrate that or raise questions about whether or not licensed goods for the University of Washington had actually been produced in that factory. And the committee as a whole, with one exception, one of the students, felt pretty strongly that asking for a termination when the license was up for renewal because of reputational issues had the same kind of effect and would exercise the same kind of pressure than 6 months earlier, which is all it would have been, terminating the license immediately and then getting embroiled in a bunch of court and juridical processes which would have sidetracked everybody. So that was our thinking.
Okay, thank you. Could you talk a little bit more about the process of actually reaching this unanimous recommendation, including various stakeholders you might have been in discussion with at that time, and particularly the other universities, relations with other universities?
Okay, so there, several of us who are on the committee are involved in networks. So there was lots of information about what other universities were doing and other stakeholders were doing. The crucial stakeholders in this were obviously the workers, but our best link to the workers was through their union representatives, the CGT, which was largely through Evangeletta Argueta, who is a very good friend of Angelina Godoy's. And so we had fairly good information about what Evangelina was thinking through Angelina, but also through her conversations and the conversations of the union with the Workers' Rights Consortium, who was regularly informing us. They were the ones who blew the whistle initially, and they were keeping us in the loop as a very interested partner. Kathy Hogan, who is the Director of Trademarks and Licensing and is ex officio on the committee, is tied into all the other trademark and licensing directors and also on the board of the FLA, the Fair Labor Association. So she was in constant conversations and networking about where other universities were on this issue and trying to pressure the FLA to do something, which it was in fact doing in a very informal way, but didn't do anything formally despite us getting Evangelina to register a complaint with them. I'm involved in the Just Supply Chains Network, which brings me into contact with a whole variety of people, as I said earlier. And I was also brought into, there was a meeting that was held in at Wisconsin, and Wisconsin was a school that was also considering and did, in fact, sever its contract. Its president did that, but what should be remembered is that Wisconsin is not a Nike school. So its clout with Nike was pretty limited, so it's considered a left-wing non-Nike school. You know, so it's like, yeah, Wisconsin did it. So it's when the University of Washington threatened to do it, with Mark Emmert about to be head of, you know, now head of National Collegiate Athletics, even though that doesn't license but clearly has reputational effects. I think that had a big impact. And Cornell, meanwhile, basically used our language, but its president acted. Ours was still determining what to do when the agreement with Nike was reached. The students were also incredible stakeholders. SLAP, through the United Students Against Sweatshops, had been waging a long campaign about Nike, and this became a very important issue, so they were very invested in an outcome, and an earlier outcome and a more radical outcome probably than the committee as a whole was willing to go, but that was a crucial part of the discussion. They had information. One of the people who attended all the committee meetings but wasn't actually a member of the committee, he attended most of them, was on the board as a student member of the WRC, so he was very tied into what was going on. A former UW person was the head of the campaign for USAS, Rod, who's back on campus now. George Robertson, who had been the RA as an undergraduate for the committee, had become involved in SLAP and had been the prior student representative, one of the student members of the WRC board. And he was all involved in this issue up until the time he left. He's now back to organizing for another union in the area. So there were a lot of student stakeholders who cared intensely about this issue. That's probably it. There was also another group that formed towards the end of this process that Angelina was involved in and I'm now part of as well, which is a faculty network. And now there's an even larger one that just formed. And so there was information being exchanged and strategies being exchanged and pressure being exchanged through that as well. And there was a letter sent by them to Nike and to the universities to pressure things. And I know that that had an influence on Nike, and I'll let Phyllis tell you more about that. The other thing that's important here, and this part may not be able to be public yet when this, you know, check with me, is that the day that the actual agreement got signed between Nike and the CGT, I got a call from the director of the Workers' Rights Consortium, an email, please call me, and I did immediately, and he wanted to thank me. And I said, why me? I mean, really, I mean that, why me? And he said, because he thinks the University of Washington played a huge role in this, that the fact that there was two board members from the University of Washington on the Nike board, both of whom he thought played a role in the outcome and who, in fact, did play a role in the outcome, as well as Mark Emmert's position, made a huge difference, and it wouldn't have if ACTL hadn't existed and if I hadn't used ACTL to brief them and to really make sure that they were on top of the issues and sensitive to them. And, you know, and that the students put pressure on as well. So that was very exciting, actually.
And what do you what did you perceive the primary strategic concerns of Nike to be during this process? What do you think they prioritized?
I think there were two different things, and they were going in different directions. One was they really didn't want to set a precedent. They don't want to have to pay for every flaw in the supply chain, even though, as an aside, they are partially responsible for creating the supply chain problem. They and Gap and a few others, you know, really initiated the whole supply chain problem. But they don't want to, because they created that way of getting production done. But they don't want to be, they know, because it's a long chain of suppliers, that they're going to be factories out of compliance, such as the Malaysian case, where they're basically doing slave trading. And surprise Nike. I mean, Nike was literally surprised to learn that. And they know that that there are going to be things like closures that they can't control. So they're really nervous about having to be fully responsible for everybody in their supply chain and being held accountable for every single flaw. They want to be understood for basically being in compliance and for even being a leader in basically being in compliance. So that was pushing in one direction, right, which was not coming to a settlement. Pushing in the other direction was their reputational concerns, and they were very nervous about too much public publicity that was negative, too much pressure, and getting it not just from the student activists, which they were very, very worried about, creates problems for them. And are sort of representative of the people who will buy their goods. You know, that's the demographic group. But they also got increasingly concerned that if too many universities jumped on the bandwagon here, and so this faculty network, and the fact that at least two universities were now on it, you know, saying something pretty strong, three, but two Nike schools, and that there was a possibility of others down the line, they were very worried about that as well. That could lead to publicity that would basically undermine their credibility and undermine their profits. So, they, you know, fundamentally they're a business. They're concerned about profits. I think some of them, are concerned about ethics, truly concerned. But they ultimately have to confront stakeholders, you know, shareholders, and have to make a profit. So, that's why they're part of the Just Supply Chain Network. You know, they understand that there's some fundamental flaw in the supply chain. But this issue, they didn't want to set a precedent. And of course, as I said, the settlement doesn't totally set a precedent, because they're not exactly giving the terminal compensation. They avoided that words. They're making some kind of arrangement with these poor workers, right?
So, do you want to just follow up on that? As one of the board members, did you hope it would set a precedent? And do you think that it, in fact, did set a precedent? I mean, the language of the settlement may be that they didn't exactly give them terminal compensation, but in the media coverage it very much came off that it was precedent setting and that they were basically paying.
Well, I'm not a board member of Nike, right?
Right. No, I mean, it's...
Just so we're clear, as part of the, of ACTL. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think it was precedent setting, and I think they know that, and I think they were very nervous about that, and they did everything they could to avoid a language that could actually... So one of the things, the other person I talked to that morning was Caitlin Morris, who sent me the settlement and said, you know, call if you want to talk, and I called, and she immediately picked up the phone, and we talked. And she said, you know, I'm really worried that you guys won't pressure other universities to do the same. And I said, well, of course we will. You know, that's part of what's going to go on here, and that part of what has to happen is for Nike to be a leader. And now I would take this as positively precedent-setting, that this is, you know, you're taking certain things out, you're going to start taking certain things out of competition here, that this is the way, this is what industry-wide practice has to be, and that we'll hold other universities to this standard. And so you'll be demanding it in your industry networks, and we'll be demanding it in union as licensees, and unions will be demanding it representing the workers, and hopefully government regulations will be demanding it and enforcing it. So I do think it was precedent-setting, whatever the language was. And I think they know that.
Yeah.
But they had to make sure that the language didn't say that.
Mm-hmm. So the unanimity...
They gave themselves some wiggle room.
Yeah, absolutely. So the unanimity of the advisory committee's recommendation seems like a pretty striking aspect of the whole story. Do you want to talk a little bit about the internal dynamics and how you built a consensus within the group?
I think time built the consensus and doing due diligence. So everybody lost patience with Nike in the end. And the way I chair things, I don't call a vote till I know I have the votes. And so I would have found them in violation months earlier. Asim would have, you know, others on the committee would have. But there were some people who weren't ready yet. And it was going to be much more effective and create much more pressure on Emmert and have much more influence on Phyllis Wise in terms of what she perceived. I mean, because even though she's kept herself apart from it, you know, she's reading the campus newspaper. She knows what's going on. And I brief her about other supply chain issues. I mean, I can't talk to her directly about the Nike case, but she really wanted to understand how the supply chain thing works, and she's on the corporate social responsibility thing. So I thought it was incredibly important that we have a unanimous vote. The fact that other universities began to consider it helped, but we were still way ahead of the pack. I mean, us in Wisconsin were out there talking about it way before any other universities were, because I talked to a whole bunch of university people, and they wanted it to happen. It wasn't happening. The students weren't pressuring, or they didn't have the right trademarks and licensing person, or they didn't have the right committee. You know, you needed like all three things to be in place. And so I'd say the University of Washington was a serious leader in this. Cornell was a crucial player by taking that position and being in Nike school. And they've played a big role in the settlement and in enforcing the settlement, because Lance Campa from Cornell is part of that process. And I think that's great. But all of that helped with unanimity, but mostly it was just waiting till everybody was there. Yeah.
So I suspect there's a rather long story about how you got involved with the advisory committee in the first place, but if you want to say briefly just sort of your background with why this interested you, you know, why did you take this on?
Well, I was on the very first variant of this committee at the University of Washington, which was back in the 80s, I think, maybe the 90s. I'd have to look it up. That's at least 10 years,
mm-hmm.
So probably the 90s. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember how old Krista Anderson is. So when I was Harry Bridges' chair, I helped encourage the initiation of what has now become SLAP. It was called SLAC. Mm-hmm. SLAP's a much better name. So it was the Student Labor Action Committee.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that they got involved with was supply chains pretty early on, got affiliated with USAS and started doing that kind of work. And so the first set of demands really had to do with leaving the FLA and joining the WRC and only belonging to the WRC.
Mm-hmm.
And adopting a stronger code of conduct. And so there was an initial advisory committee. They've changed names.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was on it for a while, and then it sort of died out, and then it revived again about 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was dragooned onto the committee and realized I really care about these issues, really, really care about these issues. It fits with a lot of, I like having something I'm doing politically. It felt like it used skills I have, knowledge I have, information I have, networks I was either part of or could help create. So it seemed like a natural issue, and I got more involved in it. Through a weird series of circumstances, very early on, I became the co-chair. I wasn't the initial co-chair.
Mm-hmm. Just to follow up on that a little, so you mentioned that the advisory committee didn't get involved right away, but you were hearing about it, and can you just say a little, were you hearing about it in the media, or...
Well, the SLAP students were telling us something.
So they were the ones that...
Yeah, because they knew about it, but until WRC actually came out with its report, there wasn't actually a whole lot of way we could do much, because we didn't have any information.
Yeah. So in terms of...
I mean, information we could use, right, as a basis for action.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah. So in terms of individual leadership, you sort of talked about the various schools and, you know, which schools were leading the way. But within the UW, which individuals did you feel like were sort of the leaders within their various groups? People we might want to interview that, you know... we might not think of right away, I guess.
Well, I would certainly talk to Rod Palmquist, who's around and who was, you know, running the USAS operation for this for quite a bit of time. I would also talk to Matt, and I can get his last name. I'm just tired of blocking names, which happens, from SLAP, who, as I said, was this student who wasn't actually on the advisory committee on trademarks and licensing, but... played a very crucial role and seemed to have a huge amount of information, and that was quite important to us. Angelina played a very important role. She was a source of credible information and real advocacy. Kathy Hogan was a real leader in this, I'd say, who's the Director of Trademarks and Licensing and ex officio on the committee, but a crucial player. She cares intensely about these issues and spends an immense amount of her time on them. I'd say Mark Emmert was a leader. You know, when I went to him with a set of issues having to do with Nike, it may have even been this one, well over a year ago or two, he started, you know, I suggested that he might get some of the other Nike schools together, and he did. He started running with the ball. You know, how he would have actually decided if Nike hadn't reached its own decision, I don't know. You know, there are these two responsibilities. You may know more than I know, or I may know things I can't talk about. But, you know, he's a good guy, and he was trying very hard to do the right thing and to put the University of Washington in a position of ethical leadership. I know he and his staff got really tired of the radical students coming into their offices. The students of this past year have been much more moderate in that kind of thing. They haven't been more moderate in their demands, but they've been more moderate in their behavior. So I think they began to realize that they were going to lose friends, not win, by pushing it too far. And aggravating some of the people they ultimately needed as allies.
To follow up on another thing, so you mentioned that the committee, the advisory committee, suspected that maybe Nike hadn't really done its due diligence in terms of determining whether or not their subcontractors were actually solvent.
That's my suspicion.
What made you think that? Is it just because it's an industry problem?
Well, they acted like they were surprised that the books had, like they were shown a different set of books, which is very possible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, on one hand, you need to hire us. We're rich. On the other hand, you need to make us pay up. We're poor.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, what can Nike do? I don't know. It's an industry problem. But it's a problem with the supply chain issue again. You know, that you have these companies, and some have solved it better than others. I take it Gap has figured some of these things out better than most.
Mm-hmm.
Nike's better than a lot of other companies that are doing similar kinds of things, but worse than, not as good as they think they are as we'd like them to be.
So maybe you can talk a little bit more about some of the alternatives that came up before the final settlement. You mentioned that they had proposed a worker training program
right.
at one point. And then the end settlement had a couple of different components. One was the cash lump sum that was for the back pay or the termination. And then there was the priority job rehiring and then the health coverage as well. And so I don't know how involved the advisory committee was in the final package, but...
The advisory committee was not involved in the final package. In fact, most of them were only barely aware that something was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Angelina knew, I knew, Kathy knew. We sort of, and some of the students might have known, I'm not sure, we were all told not to make it too public because we didn't want to, so we weren't even sure how to tell each other what we knew, right? So the way we were getting it from various sources, and we could all tell this was really quite an important moment. The priority hiring is something we had talked about with them earlier, that there really should be priority hiring, that should be a crucial part of the package. And in fact, that we thought that Nike should require Hugger and Vision Techs to, that they should give some contracts to Hugger and Vision Techs in order to enable them to give priority hiring to the workers, that would be another way to solve the problem, mm-hmm. right? Or at least part of the problem, to at least get the workers paid and get whatever health insurance is legally owed under Honduran law. That's part of what happened in the Estefel case, which we also helped to settle. But that was not something that Nike was willing to do, was to actually contract in order to create the jobs.
And so how happy were you, the board and you personally, with the final settlement?
It's not a board. We have to be careful about it.
Sorry.
It's a committee.
With the final settlement package, and you talked about Nike avoiding the language of terminal compensation.
I was ecstatic with it.
Okay.
Ecstatic. You know, the Estefel case, one could argue, I argued that it was a glass half full, and Angelina argues that it was a glass half empty, right? And we're both right. I mean, that's a question of perspective and what you think is should be done. In terms of the Nike case, the workers actually got more money than they had originally asked for, and they got more protections than are covered by Honduran law, like the priority hiring. Mm-hmm. It's not a requirement. I thought it was stupendous,
mm-hmm.
frankly.
What do you think motivated such a good outcome? I mean, given... you know, how much they had to lose in terms of setting precedent, being responsible for doing the same in the future, potentially. I mean...
I think they got to the point where if they didn't do something major, they'd lost the game. By doing something major, they at least had a chance of recouping their reputation.
Yeah.
And they will still treat each case as a singular case, because they've got language in there that allows them to, as I said, there's wiggle room.
Mm-hmm.
What made them do it? There are different stories about that, but I think one really important story is that what happened in the board,
mm-hmm.
what happened in the Nike board, and hopefully Phyllis can tell you about that. I can't. And I've heard various versions of the same story from several people, so Phyllis is not necessarily my source.
Mm-hmm.
But there was definitely some pressure from within the board and the corporate social responsibility part of the board especially, that something had to be done. And I think the current Phil Knight doesn't get it,
mm-hmm.
totally, but the CEO, the current CEO, sort of does.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for some reason it was got to be a perfect positive storm,
mm-hmm.
in the middle of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes happens, and we all lucked out, and particularly the workers lucked out.
Absolutely.
That it was. But it came after a lot of hard work by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Makia's solidarity is crucial here. I mean, they really worked hard. Workers' Rights Consortium people killed themselves on this. Jeremy, who's their researcher on the ground, and Central America, really was... I mean, he gave his lifeblood to this one and to the Estefel case. The FLA people working behind the scenes actually did some work here, though I think we're all a little dissatisfied with them.
Mm-hmm.
All, I don't know, but I certainly am. And I'm not a huge antagonist of theirs, but, WRC clearly did a lot. FLA didn't even really totally respond when Evangelina put in a complaint, just that it couldn't cover it.
Just to follow up on the faculty network, is that an internal network at the UW, or is that
no? It's something that the person who sort of, who might have initiated it is Peter Evans, who's at Berkeley.
Okay.
But he's certainly the one who sends out the emails, and it involves people at Wisconsin, people at Berkeley, people here, people around the country.
Okay.
And it's growing.
So it's big.
It's not big yet, but it's growing.
But it's inter-university, at least. So.
It's definitely inter-university, and there's a new one, as I said, that I just got. They forwarded, Peter sent me a message about, in case I hadn't heard about it, to join up to that one. So, but I think it also played a role. I mean, because it just raised the likelihood a little more that other universities would get on the bandwagon. It meant that you weren't just counting on pressure from students, which is periodic, and one cohort is active and another one isn't. And the student activism here has been crucial, so in no way do I want to underplay it. But the problem with student activism, as we know, is it goes and comes in waves, having to do with a particular set of people who are there that particular year in that particular place. Whereas faculty tend to be much more long-term. So if they are developing these kinds of commitments, and if some administrators are developing these kinds of commitments, even if the faculty leave Berkeley, they go to Texas, or they go to Wisconsin, or they go to Harvard, or they go wherever. So there's still faculty who have these commitments and just extend the network somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that added a scarifying dimension to this, to Nike.
Just to very briefly follow up on your last question, would you say your opinion about the settlement was representative of the other members of the ACTL committee, or were there other components that other people would have liked to see in the package that weren't there?
I think everybody was happy with it. That's my sense.
Okay.
Angelina's not on the committee, and she can tell you whether she was, but I think she was. Because she reported to me, because we realized that we both knew what was going on, so we started talking a little bit about it, and she said, Evangelina, because I told her that Makia Solidarity had told me, right? They were reporting to me with the ants. I said, I hear that it's going to be a good settlement, and Angelina said, Evangelina is very excited about it. And if Evangelina was, then Angelina would be, because... she's trying to serve the interests of the workers, and she knows Evangelina is.
So it seems like in coming up with the information for the committee to consider, you relied pretty heavily on WRC, Makia Solidarity, the USAS, and the SLAB students. Were there any other sources of information that were...
Well, the other universities. So, we were information sharing to the
mm-hmm.
extent possible, particularly with Wisconsin, but also increasingly with others. I mean, I had called people, and so had Kathy. I think the other thing to say, this is changing a little bit, but the other thing to say about the final agreement negotiation was one of the things that Caitlin reported to me was that the negotiator, Jeff Hermanson, who is now working with the CGT and comes out of an academic background but also a trade union background, said he was incredibly effective. So I think that was another piece of the puzzle here was, over many of these kinds of situations, we've all been learning a lot about what we need to do and what will work. So getting other universities involved, creating additional sources of pressure, like this faculty network, the union hiring a negotiator who might have some, who wasn't just in the Honduras situation and had some sensibility about how to deal with a corporation like Nike, as opposed to just the employer, the immediate employer, which is what the union really knows the most about. I think Makia Solidarity's gotten more sophisticated. I think WRC's gotten more sophisticated. So I think the game is changing a little bit. And I think the flaws in the supply chain are becoming evident. And so you know, when you're talking about what Nike was trying to protect, it's also in some ways trying to protect the supply chain system, though even though it might have to change it some and increase a shorter chain rather than a super long chain. And I think it's just much more aware because of these cases about the flaws in the system.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, a perfect positive storm.
Yeah. Which makes it interesting.
Yeah, very interesting case.
Do you want to say anything more about the code of conduct? I mean, you already talked about it somewhat, saying that sort of the disclosure violation is fairly minor and that the code is narrow as it stands right now, but that in reality the committee was sort of, it was interested regardless of where the product had actually been produced. Do you want to
the current code has nothing to say about terminal compensation, right? Which is one of its flaws.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easily interpreted as extremely narrow on what constitutes the basis for violation, i.e. that production has to be of a particular university's licensed product. So it doesn't matter if the university's sports team's clothing were made there. I mean, we could prove, perhaps, that the University of Washington's football team uniforms were made there, but we couldn't prove that the T-shirts we buy in the bookstore were made there. It wouldn't be in violation, technically, right? So that's a flaw in the code. The code is being revised now. The code we use at the University of Washington is basically the FLA code, Fair Labor Association code, and they've been, for the last 2 years, been working in a process to revise the code, given the number of stakeholders and the number of ideas and thoughts and whatever it takes a long time to negotiate something like that. I take it they're pretty close. Kathy Hogan is involved in that process and has been interacting with the members of the committee who have been tasked with Bruce Kochis in particular, and one of our former student members who no longer is around, Andrew Schwartz, were working on the code issues for the committee, and so have devised, you know, raised a whole series of questions about what the code was covering, wasn't covering, should be covering, might not be in our interest to have covered, what are the areas which are going to be necessarily confusing and ambivalent, like, you know, how do you define living wage? What's the right way to ensure that the wage is the highest possible wage for the situation? All those kinds of issues. So Kathy's on the subcommittee of FLA that's working on the code, and she's been checking in with Bruce before she gets on these telephone conversations, so our committee's having some influence on that. But ultimately, our code is going to have to be a code that is adopted by a number of universities, or else Nike and other licensees won't have anything to do with it because they don't want to have to figure out individual codes for each product that they produce, especially since often they produce a whole bunch of T-shirts and then they get stamped someplace else. You know, they don't even know where they're going to go. So it's going to be the FLA code or the WRC code, and the WRC code Nike won't accept because it has things in it, and I'm using Nike here, brands won't accept because it has things in it they're not ready for yet. So this is going to continue to be a tension in the committee because clearly the SLAP students and others in the committee, including some of the academics, Asim at times, me at times, Bruce at times, even Deborah Glassman from the business school at times, have wanted to push the code farther than the FLA people probably will push it, mm-hmm. and closer to where the WRC is. But realistically, at least the academics recognize that that's just, and the guy, Jim Ritter, from who represents staff on the committee. All of us at different times and different issues would like it to go further. We'll see what the new one looks like. It sounds like it's going to be a big improvement. You know, it's at least 10 years old. So we've learned a lot, as I said. Yeah. We've learned about situations which weren't covered by the code.
No, I don't think I have any final questions.
Was there anything else that we haven't talked about that you think is important to be included in the public record that you can think of right now?
I do think that having an institutionalized advisory committee or licensing committee of, you know, advisory committee on trademarks and licensing advisory committee, whatever it gets called, even if it doesn't have final determinative power, even though it's an advisory committee, which it clearly is now, is really crucial for bringing these issues to light. That if we didn't have the committee, there would be very little way to have dealt with the Estevelt case as a university, or the Nike case, or the Russell case. And in all three cases, the University of Washington has played a very crucial role in them. And it's not because we're so special people here, but rather through a series of processes that have been created by a combination of students, administrators, and faculty. We have institutionalized a process for deliberating on these things and gathering information on them that enables us to speak out on them, and that has consequences in the long run for the supply chain. And there are other universities that have also done that, and they're the ones you hear acting, right? And when you see Berkeley's a radical school, but their committee doesn't seem to be as well institutionalized, or institutionalized in a different way. So, you know, as this research goes forward, I hope this is something you look at to see if there are differences, systematic differences in these committees and in their structures. Is it particular leadership issues? Is it powers issues? Is it compositional issues? Is it just interest at the time issues? But the way our committee is organized now, it isn't just a question of what we're interested in. We know that if a violation comes up, we have to pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm. I guess one question that comes to mind after that is, so the primary role of the advisory committee is to advise President Emmer, or whoever the president of UW is at that time. How did you manage your relationship with him to make sure your presentation of the information was effective?
Well, there are a couple ways we do that, really. Mm-hmm. One is that he has put one of his people on the committee, right? So Norm is on the committee. And Norm is one of the public spokespersons for the University of Washington and an advisor to the president, and I'm a confidant of a certain sort, you know, not the highest level, but so it gives a. On the one hand, it's kind of a funny thing. On the other hand, it gives some legitimacy with the president because he's getting another report about what's going on in the committee that gives some credibility about the quality of our deliberations and whatever. So I think that's ultimately a good thing. At least so far, it has been. And Norm, too, has been involved since the very beginning, like I have. So he's gotten quite knowledgeable and really cares about these issues, though he was one of the last to come on board in this. Well, so he was one of the people I was waiting for to turn. He wasn't against it. He was very impatient with Nike, but he just wasn't ready to take that step until when we finally called that vote. The other thing that helped, of course, was Emmer was my student a long time ago, and I know him independently, so I'm not afraid of him, you know. And I found him very easy to talk to, and he was very supportive of this whole process. And he reinstitutionalized it, and I think in a way that will survive now, beyond him or any other president. So that also helped. But I think ultimately any committee chair and any committee member will take seriously a meeting with the president about a set of issues which they've been tasked to be an advisory committee on. So I think the nature of the structure of it sort of ensures that it will he'll listen to it unless the composition of the committee is totally screwy. And that's basically under the president's control because the president appoints the committee. And it's got terms, right? So the composition goes out of whack and you can adjust it. And I think out of whack here means not that there aren't, not that there should be a diversity of views and perspectives in the committee. And I think that's quite crucial, and that has been maintained and preserved. Not always to the student's satisfaction. They would like it all to be, I mean, I'm now seen as a moderate, I think, at best, by them. And they'd like it all to be, I'd be the absolute outer limit of what they would find acceptable. And they'd like it, you know, totally stocked with people they know will immediately find Nike or Russell or whoever in violation. I think it has to be much more diverse than that to really have effectiveness. And I think that's been maintained. But you also want people who actually come to the meetings, who will engage in the required deliberation and self-education, who will engage in the education of the larger university community. So their qualities, and you know, sometimes some of us have time for that, who have those commitments, and sometimes we don't. So it can shift over time. Mm-hmm. You know, Seems proved an incredibly invaluable member of the committee because he has a kind of knowledge and information about regulatory patterns that almost no one else in the world has. But he's also been extremely busy in a variety of other dimensions. So I can imagine over time he might have to be replaced if, you know, if this becomes very, very tertiary to him. At the moment it's not. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just mm-hmm. using him as an example. Mm-hmm. And you get crazy sometimes. Yeah. You know, you get people who just won't let you move forward on a discussion. Mm-hmm. We have a very functional committee right now. Mm-hmm. And we're about to get the new students on it, so we'll see how it goes.
One final thing, which I think you've kind of touched on already, but just if you had any further thoughts. You talked about institutionalizing trade and licensing committees at other universities. Are there any other relationships or processes that took place during this negotiation that you think could inform future negotiation processes of this nature?
Well, I would really like, I mean, I talked to the WRC about their providing as a service to their universities, you know, information about what other universities are doing. So I didn't have to try to find the phone number and locate the right person. I mean, Scott would give me the name if I asked for it. It wasn't that, and the phone number, and even some information, but he wouldn't give me the actual, you know, he would say, Rutgers looks like they might be willing to do something. These are the universities that are, like, at least considering something. But, you know, it wasn't like he was, or his staff was providing that kind of information to us. I could have used a newsletter every week or two saying, Cornell is now considering this, University of Washington has just done that, Rutgers is deciding to do nothing, X is doing Y, and he said they can't do that. So I don't quite understand why they can't. He gave me some argument about it, and I know he really believes that they can't. I mean, so there's probably something in the bylaws that is inhibiting him. But I'd like to see that changed.
Yeah.
Or the right staffing. I mean, we shouldn't have to do so much work to connect to each other. Mm-hmm. And the faculty network thing won't totally solve that because it's, you know, whoever signs up for that faculty network. So you really want these licensing advisory committees to have a better be better networked into each other, and that's very hard to ask any particular advisory committee to take on as its job mm-hmm. or to sustain it. So I'd rather see the WRC or the FLA or, you know, some group we're paying
mm-hmm.
do that. And the WRC seems the appropriate one.
Yeah.
So that's my one that's a complaint with the way the system's operating now.
Okay.
Other things? I think they do a very good job of, WRC does a very good job of the fire alarm. And I find their reports pretty compelling. I know that Nike's suspicious of them, but I think they do their homework and, you know, put the brands on the defensive to show that the evidence is wrong. Or that there's other evidence we're not looking at. because otherwise they wouldn't come forward with it. So I think that works. I'd like to see FLA take a more activist role. I don't think it's done all it could. I know that Jorge Dominguez, who's the second in command but actually runs the FLA, was also fed up with Nike on this issue and said to me on a couple of occasions, why won't they settle? Why won't they just do something? Well, I was thinking, Jorge, why don't you help make them do something? So FLA took a somewhat low profile or did it behind the scenes, and I would like to see them, again, they're an organization paid by a combination of the brands and the universities and others, and they should take a more active role in some of these things. Everybody's stretched in resources, but this was an important case. I think this is one you stretch to. So I don't think the system's perfect, and I still think the whole supply system is a problem. That the longer the chain, the more problems you can have. Too much stuff gets hidden.
Do you have anything else,
Anne?
No, I think I'm done.
I think I'm done too.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Cheers.